Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you non-monetized, endorsement-free insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 146, it's Journal Club time again, as I'm joined in our final episode of 2018 by Drs. Daniel Chow and Ajay Kurian to discuss three recent publications. First, the PIVOT trial comparing primary vitrectomy and pneumatic retinopexy, then the FLUID study looking at the effect of residual subretinal fluid in wet age-related macular degeneration, and finally, a study out of Stanford University published in the British Journal of Ophthalmology looking at timing of macula-off retinal detachment repair. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina specialists. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Daniel Chow, in the airport, but still dedicated to the cause on the West Coast. Dan, how are you?
Thank you, Jay. Happy to be here.
We don't want to even know where you are. It's like, where in the world is Carmen San Diego? We'll figure out context clues, and if the listeners can guess by the end what airport Dan is in, they won't get a prize because we don't have any prizes. And then also in alphabetical order, Ajay Kurian from the University of Rochester, who has a cold, but again, dedicated to causes on the air.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
So we are going to go over the Journal Club, as we do always, of three articles published recently, and we kind of break it down. We'll talk about what the article showed, maybe some limitations, and then extrapolate what we thought about the article. So the first article we're going to look at was the PIVOT trial. This was the pneumatic retinopexy versus vitrectomy for the management of primary regmatogenous retinal detachment outcomes randomized trial. This was published by Hillier et al. In Ophthalmology, accepted on November 6th and published online within the month. Ajay, do you just want to tell us a little bit about what the PIVOT trial was designed to show and what it showed?
Sure. So this is a study that was a prospective study comparing pneumatic retinopexy versus primary vitrectomy for regmatized retinal detachments that essentially fit the criteria for what we would normally think about doing a pneumatic retinopexy for. So either a single break or a group of breaks within 1 clock hour and above the 8 and 4 o'clock meridians. And the patients were randomized. They were stratified based on macula status. And they essentially compared the outcomes for visual acuity for these patients. And they found that there was actually a better visual acuity outcome at all the time points in the pneumatic retinopexy group compared to the vitrectomy group. And in terms of anatomic success, there was equivalent overall anatomic success, but for a single surgery success, there was a higher rate of success for the pneumatic retinopexy compared to vitrectomy compared to the pneumatic retinopexy.
Right. So primary success, 93% for vitrectomy, 80.8% for pneumatic. That was just met statistical significance. Secondary anatomic success was 98.6 and 90.7, very similar. And then obviously the higher cataract rate in the PPV arm versus the pneumatic arm. So Dan, kind of your takeaways from the study. First, let's talk, okay, before we talk about our implications, limitations of the study. So Dan, any limitations that occurred to you when you read this?
Well, you know, I thought this was actually a really well designed study, very thoughtfully designed. It really tried to control for a lot of things that normally aren't taken into an account in you know, these types of studies, especially like surgical comparisons. I think, you know, number one, it's a prospective study. Number two, you know, it's randomized. And so I generally really liked the study and thought that the in general that the you know, these results were really important to consider and take a look at.
Ajay, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's a great study, and I think it addresses a really important question. Looking at the visual acuity outcomes, you know, the one thing that I was really interested in getting more data about is the visual acuity for those patients who didn't have cataract surgery. And so the study investigators were very attentive to the fact that the cataract progression might make the visual acuity outcomes skewed to look more poor in the vitrectomy group. And so they're very on top of doing cataract surgery for these patients. But there was a subset of patients within the vitrectomy group who didn't have cataract surgery. And I was curious to see if that group of patients' visual acuity skewed the results to make it look worse for the vitrectomy group. They did do control for baseline phakic status for the statistical analysis, but since so many patients wound up getting cataract surgery, it still is a question about whether there was a differential outcome for the spinal visual acuity. And we just don't have that data presented in the study.
I mean, I think it's hard to take a conclusion with that limitation that the vision is better with pneumatic. I think it's one of the scenarios where it's more useful to say that the vision is definitely not inferior with a pneumatic. I mean, that the outcomes are at least equivalent and potentially better depending on how the cataract affected it. But like you said, I mean, some patients may not opt to have the cataract surgery. I mean, 65% of the phakic patients had cataract surgery before 12 months, but that's a third of the patients. And we know that some of those may have visually significant cataracts. And you're talking about ETDRS visual acuity, and you're talking about, you know, pretty small differences in ETDRS letters that definitely could be influenced by cataracts. So I think that's a reasonable thing to point out.
The way the cataract grading was done was that if you were pseudophakic, you essentially got a zero on the cataract scale. And so that definitely, you know, there was just so many more pseudophakic patients in that vitrectomy arm at the end of that study at the 12-month mark. And so that's why I was wondering, even though the cataract scores are lower for the overall for the vitrectomy group at that point, the question is whether, since you're counting all those pseudophakic patients as zeros, it begs the question about whether those phakic patients actually have more advanced cataracts, even though the average is lower.
I think that's an absolutely great point. And I think, I completely agree. Like, looking at visual acuity as an outcome when you have such a confounding variable as development of a cataract definitely can skew things a lot. You know, and I think this is really, I think this study then kind of brings up really the power of hopefully some, you know, future initiatives, say, for instance, looking at the iris registry, for instance. Now, if you can group much larger groups of individuals and hopefully control for a number of variables, then you can really get even more data. Obviously, it's not controlled, it's not prospective, but hopefully can also, you know, significantly look into this subject. And, you know, one other thing that I thought was very interesting that wasn't really addressed in this was, you know, in the terms of, if you look at the number of patients, there were 80 patients per arm, and the vast majority of them were for macula on detachments. There were about a smaller percentage, maybe about 23%, that were macula off. And one interesting theory that would be interesting to test is that you can imagine, you know, with a pneumatic retinopexy, the amount of fluid absorption is much more physiologic, you know, as it's being pumped out by the RPE versus when we do vitrectomy. You know, we're doing, you know, generally we're doing airflow exchange. We are draining the retina flat in a very quick amount of time, usually in a minute or so. And so originally I thought, I was like, oh, you know, could the fact that this physiologic, you know, drainage of fluid by the RPE actually, you know, prevent damage that might be caused by drainage through a surgical retinotomy? And I think, you know, that would be an interesting thing to look at and could be in, you know, something interesting to explore to see whether that is a variable that could bias, you know, you could imagine if you saw then visual acuity outcomes appear in that, then that could really suggest something about that particular step and how it might influence visual acuity in the future. I think it's kind of an interesting question looking forward.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of interesting little notes within this paper. So the first is what you referenced. That's been argued and discussed before, Dan, and that's a great point about this idea of, is the RP pumping the retina into place versus us actively doing it somehow different from an outcomes perspective? And that was initially discussed in the early 90s, but well before our time, when they looked at scleral buckles versus pneumatics, and buckles rely more on the RP than vitrectomy does, given what we do. Even though in this study, one of the interesting things when I was looking at the methods was how do they determine drainage during the vitrectomy? And it seems like they generally encourage doctors to drain from the break, but left it up to their discretion. It doesn't really say anywhere in the paper what percentage of patients were retinotomy versus PFO versus from the break. The other thing that's interesting when you look at the results is, and this is just a bizarre aside,
the number of patients receiving laser treatment, did you guys see this? That for it was only 74% of the vitrectomy patients received laser treatment according to their results, which I assume means that a quarter of them must have had cryo at the time of vitrectomy, which I know is done, but I didn't realize would be so common. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just an interesting side note, because I do think that's a little bit of an outlier in terms of how most people approach a vitrectomy.
That's true. Yeah, I didn't catch that earlier when I first read this paper.
This is kind of like a broader implication. You know, given, say, let's say these results are like they're non-inferior, and I think there have been a number of papers that suggest, like definitely from a cost-effective analysis, like pneumatic retinopexy is a far superior cost-effective procedure compared to vitrectomy in terms of visual outcomes, et cetera, et cetera. And then when you think of removing more to like a value-based health outcomes a system in the future, you think, well, you know, should we be doing, you know, I think right now there's been a lot of autonomy in terms of how retina specialists treat retinal detachments, but you can imagine if, you know, if you're solely looking at it from a health policy point of view, looking at value-based treatment, well, it just seems like pneumatic retinopexy is actually it makes a lot of sense to start, you know, most patients off with a pneumatic retinopexy, and if they fail, then quickly move into vitrectomy, which is sometimes what's done in countries like Canada, where maybe there's less access or there's more of these kinds of constraints. And so it'll be interesting thinking about how that affects things in the future, even if you get to the idea like, well, does insurance start to like, oh, we're not going to authorize, I don't think it'll get quite this far, but will an insurance authorize a vitrectomy if you haven't tried a pneumatic retinopexy? And I think from a system standpoint, like, and you're trying to save money, I think, you know, there is some validity to that argument. And then the question is, well, as training programs and retina fellowships, I think I would say most, I can't say for all, but many programs, I think, you know, bias against pneumatic retinopexy, where perhaps we're not doing enough to, you know, really maximize the success of this procedure.
Yeah. Ajay, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Dan. You know, what's interesting is that this paper had a very high success rate for primary vitrectomy as well. And so there certainly was a higher anatomic outcome for the vitrectomy group, but it is especially high compared to other reports, especially comparing the two. I think from speaking to the senior author for this paper, they are going to be presenting some of the OCT data, and so hopefully that'll help try to explain why there is that visual acuity outcome difference in these two groups. And so that would be very interesting to see if there is actually any differences in the way that the OCT is looking to account for that difference.
So before we move on, I mean, can I just say something? I think it's a very well-designed study, very good results. And I think the only thing that I look at is, does the success rate really surprise any of you guys? Because, I mean, they picked good candidates for pneumatic retinopexy, which is ideal, and that's good. And you should try to pick good candidates for a procedure. The success rate was 80% primary anatomic success. I mean, that's essentially what's been reported by people who have experience and choose patients with good selection criteria. I don't think any of us feel that number is lower. And it is higher for vitrectomy, and that brings in the cost issues Dan was talking about, whether how many vitrectomies you need to do to achieve that difference. But the actual success numbers didn't surprise me. I don't know if they surprised either of you.
You know, I agree. I don't think they, in terms of like, it's well in line with what's reported in the literature. I wonder, though, if there's a bias. The people who are participating like in these trials are actually, again, people who are experienced in pneumatic retinopexy. And, you know, when we think about, you know, what does it mean to be experienced in pneumatic retinopexy? I mean, I would imagine, you know, you probably want to do at least 100 of these or so to feel like really comfortable and really maximize the outcome. Because I think there is an art to doing it, you know, when is it working, when is it not, to really maximize the outcomes. And I would argue that in our current future retinal training fellowships is that most people aren't reaching those kinds of numbers to feel really supremely comfortable with pneumatic retinopexy. And I think part of that is that I think pneumatic retinopexy, except for some exceptions, is you know, a distant third in terms of how people are treating retinal detachment in most of these training programs. So, you know, one thought is that, you know, everyone worries about, oh, is scleral buckling a dying art? Well, I you could argue the same thing also about pneumatic retinopexy. Well, if people have really ever given it a chance. You know, I know in my own training programs, you know, we would do some, but, you know, it's very easy to get, when you just have a couple of bad results and then you think, well, you know, this isn't working. And have you really pushed through and really done enough to really feel like, okay, I'm really a master, I feel very skilled and comfortable in this procedure.
Well, moving forward to the next paper top is the fluid study. This was also published in Ophthalmology in the last month. And just second pulling up that reference here. So this was the fluid study is tolerating subretinal fluid in neovascular age-related macular degeneration treated with ranibizumab using a treat and extend regimen, 24-month results. This was by Geimer et al. As on behalf of the fluid investigators. Dan, you just want to tell us a little bit about what this study showed and how they sort of designed it?
Yeah, this was going after a really interesting question. And the question was essentially, you know, can you tolerate a little bit of does the presence of subretinal fluid affect visual outcomes in patients treated for neovascular macular degeneration? And so this was a multi-centered phase 4 masked non-inferiority clinical trial. I believe it was at least sponsored in part by Novartis. So these were patients with treatment naive wet AMD, and then they all received ranibizumab monthly until they either had complete resolution of subretinal fluid, or if they had what's called subretinal fluid a tolerant group, which meant there was no fluid except for subretinal fluid less than 200 microns at the foveal center. And then at that point, then they would start doing a treat and extend protocol. And with this subretinal fluid tolerant group, they would allow for a little bit of subretinal fluid. And then the non-inferiority margin was 5 letters, which is similar to other non-inferiority trials in terms of looking at comparison of anti-VEGF molecules. And so bottom line, after 24 months, essentially the visual acuity was non-inferior to the subretinal fluid tolerant arm compared to the completely dry arm.
Ajay, your reactions?
So I think it was an interesting study. You know, I think for a lot of my training, the emphasis was on to try to keep the retina as dry as possible for these AMD patients. I think that this study, as well as some other studies that have been published, has shown that the intraretinal fluid might be more visually significant. And so I think that was some of the basis of why the study was done with not tolerating the intraretinal fluid, but tolerating the subretinal fluid. It was interesting to see that you were able to get non-inferior visual acuity outcomes. There wasn't a big difference in the actual number of injections. I think it was a little less than one per year. And so it seems like by tolerating subretinal fluid, you're not necessarily making a huge difference in your number of injections, but it does give you a little bit more flexibility with perhaps figuring out your timeline for extending some patients.
Yeah, I think that this isn't a concept that was shown in some of the major trials that inspired this study. I think the thing that we're all concerned about, besides the fact that there, if you don't treat patients with fluid, there may be loss of vision, is that fluid may represent choroidal and vascular membrane activity, and maybe that places patients at risk of vision-threatening hemorrhage, especially when they're monocular or the vision in the other eye isn't good for macular degeneration. This is actually very encouraging. And the only thing I would say is, even though the differences in injections were significant technically between the groups, it wasn't that big a difference for 2 years. I mean, extrapolated over many years, it would be a big difference. But, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but the number of injections was 15.8, a mean of 15.8 in one group and 17 in the other group. So it was only one injection really difference between the two groups over 2 years. So that was the only thing I saw. It was, even with their relaxed kind of protocol, it didn't really seem to make a huge difference in terms of the injection burden.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I was talking about before. It just wasn't as much of a difference as I would have expected with the relaxed criteria.
I mean, I guess the question is, do you guys see AMD patients? And obviously, we don't have as mature practices as some people out there to qualify this. But I mean, how many patients with AMD do we see with significant intraretinal fluid? I feel like we're usually following the subretinal fluid, in which case, you know, the relaxed criteria is similar, essentially. It is different than the intensive criteria. But my point is, like, if we're just tracking the subretinal fluid, I mean, I don't know. This goes back to your question, Ajay. I mean, the quantification thing here is interesting, right? Of they have a certain criteria for the SRF, but it was, they basically just said if you didn't have intraretinal fluid, it was okay. But I think that we're not usually comparing in real life patients' resolution of intraretinal fluid. I feel like most of our patients start with subretinal fluid only and still have only subretinal fluid only. So we don't necessarily have that distinction to be like, oh, okay, the intraretinal fluid's better, now we can start extending.
Sometimes you have these patients who, like, you know, they're responding well to anti-VEGF, but maybe there's a little bit of some subretinal fluid, and you're thinking, okay, how aggressive do I need to be, or do I think about extending? And, you know, I think at least this study provides, you know, it doesn't answer the complete question, but saying, like, you know, maybe we can be a little bit tolerant of subretinal fluid, and then depending on the situation, perhaps it may make sense to, you know, to consider that, okay, we don't need to keep trying to change medications, or maybe it's really hard for them to get in, and we can think about extending their interval. So it just provides us a little bit more leeway and comfort in that we don't have to aim for absolute complete fluid regression.
Ajay?
And I think also for our patients, it could be a little bit of peace of mind. You know, I have a lot of patients who come in and they're very anxious about seeing the picture and making sure that there's no fluid there. And I think that a study like this, it shows that, you know, there can be some fluid there and it's okay. It's probably something that would ease the minds of some of our patients who are now, just after getting so many injections, very tuned to what the OCT results are. You know, the other thing is that we are certainly concerned about the risks of continued atrophy with more injections. And so, you know, like you were saying before, it might not be a large amount just over 1 or 2 years, but a lot of these patients do have just, you know, the rest of their lifetime filled with injections. And so it can add up and maybe potentially decrease some of the risk of atrophy progression.
And I guess along with that, with all things, right? I mean, I think 2-year follow-up, that's great. That's about the most we can expect with these studies. But it's possible that as we extend longer, then, you know, potentially that subretinal fluid is detrimental to visual acuity. Or as Ajay said, reversely, you know, if anti-VEGF injections are actually correlated with geographic atrophy, perhaps that leads to vision loss. But, you know, I think that's very difficult data to come on in terms of, you know, long-term, because, you know, usually probably the mean number of years that we're treating an AMD patient is probably over 10, at least for the most part. So really understanding the long-term outcomes is very helpful before making any complete, you know, blanket statements one way or another about fluid.
Any final thoughts, Ajay, before we move forward?
No, I think it was an interesting study and very well done, and you know, looking forward to seeing some of the more long-term data for this.
Well, the last study we're going to talk about was published in British Journal of Ophthalmology just this December, and it was entitled "Reductions in Final Visual Acuity Occur Within Even First 3 Days of a Macula Off Retinal Detachment." That's a very attention-grabbing title. And written by the team out of Stanford, Margaret Grevin, Ted Lang, Ruan Silva et al., with Darius Mushfeghi is also on the paper, along with Ira Shacker, Peter Karth. And I'll just talk a little bit about this study. This was a retrospective study where they looked back at patients who either got a vitrectomy or a buccal vitrectomy for a macula-involving detachment at Stanford over a 10-year period. They found 79 eyes that kind of met their criteria. And what they looked at is they looked at visual acuity outcomes and used a model essentially looking at the time from the macula off status and the time to surgery, as well as preoperative vision and the lens status, and kind of used it to see what were predictors of postoperative vision as independent predictors when they kind of controlled for the other variables. So they had 52 eyes that were repaired within 3 days of the macula detaching based on history. And they had 27 eyes in the other group that was between 4 and 7 days. And the two groups, the biggest thing, I think the takeaways were, again, preoperative vision tends to predict postoperative vision. And lens status, again, predicts your postoperative vision. But the most interesting, or I guess controversial slash point for discussion takeaway from that, from the conclusions, was patients who had surgery within the first day, which was 17 eyes, versus in 3 days, which was at 3 days, 7 eyes, there was a significant difference in vision between those two groups. So again, I think this is obviously very, very something that will inspire a lot of discussion. And I applaud the art authors for writing this, because I'll tell you my thoughts on this in a minute. Dan, kind of your reactions to the paper and thoughts on the limitations of this sort of analysis?
Sure. No, I mean, I think this is definitely an important area to the study. And I thought, you know, the results, of course, were very interesting and hopefully will stimulate a lot of further studies. You know, I think one thing, in one way, I'm not surprised by these results. And it's always something that kind of got to me in terms of when we think about the timing of retina surgery, you know, like some of the general guys, with a macula off attachment, we can usually wait a little bit, sometimes as long as, you know, generally like within a week should be okay. But, you know, we know from more, and they reference this from more of the basic science, when the retina is detached, you know, these photoreceptors are not healthy. They are dying. They're releasing cell death signals. And so you can imagine, you know, intuitively, at least, the sooner that we can reattach these photoreceptors so they can get more trophic support, the more that they're going to survive. And, you know, it turns out in a lot of the studies, like, you know, there's been no difference between these two groups. But, of course, there's so many variables that can confound it. You know, preoperative vision, lens status, et cetera, et cetera. And so potentially, you know, this type of data, hasn't been, you know, maybe there has really been a difference and we just haven't had the right carefully controlled studies to really tease these things out. And so I think this is, again, where it would be great, again, if we use kind of these larger databases like Iris or other things like that to really go back and really try to carefully control, develop these models and really see how these will bear out in larger cases. But I think this does hint at, you know, a potential large way in which we can improve visual acuities and retinal detachment outcomes. And a lot of this is work that's been done by David Zax and others who study photoreceptor death and trying to find, you know, are there adjuncts that we can give to retinal detachment surgery that might protect or help the cells last longer. And so in his lab, they found some FAST ligands, which seem to be important for protecting these photoreceptors. And now he started a company, ONL Therapeutics, which is looking to try to see whether these kind of molecules can actually improve visual outcomes in patients with retinal detachments. I think this is very exciting and it could be a potential big breakthrough in terms of improving visual acuities for retinal detachments. And I think currently they're planning some clinical trials. I have no involvement in the company. I've just been very interested in seeing what's been going on. But I think, you know, these results kind of bear out that, you know, we have to kind of look a little bit further in terms of what's the best way to treat these retinal detachments.
And before Ajay asks your thoughts, just some notes. Dan referenced the confounding factors. Remember, it's retrospective study, retrospective data dependent on the patient's history to kind of determine when the macula slash fovea was detached. Although there could be VH, there could be symptomatic vitreous floaters, there could be other reasons the vision may have decreased in conjunction with the detachment that may precede the macula coming off. Again, they didn't have any data on the detachment height, and maybe that was variable. And we're talking about small numbers. I mean, 17 eyes is a lot, and I think it's again commendable they were able to put this together and piece this together. But 17 eyes isn't huge in the context of doing statistical analyses, and these small differences may just be noise. Dan, like you said, there's a lot of preclinical and basic science data suggesting this. Interestingly enough, the previous clinical trials have really not shown this. This is where kind of the 7 day rule or the 6 to 10 day rule has come from. Ajay, what are your kind of takeaways, and how do you interpret these results in the context of your practice?
So, you know, I agree with Dan. The basic science data and just what we would normally would think as, you know, makes sense, is that the sooner you repair the retinal detachment, the better the visual acuity outcomes are. I do agree that there are some shortcomings with the study just because you're relying on the patient history. And so you're not as sure about whether the actual duration of macular detachment is necessarily correct, especially as you get further out. I find that patients are less reliable with that exact history than if it just happened that day, for example. When you're looking at the outcomes, you don't see a huge difference between 3, 4, and 5 days. It looks like there's sort of a much bigger jump at 6 days in this data. But like you said, when you're looking at each individual day, it's just a small number of patients for each one of those individual days. And they use that cutoff of 3 days or more than 3 days. But there does seem to be some variation within that, within those cutoffs. In terms of how this is affecting my practice, you know, I think that it's a little hard to determine whether this study would necessarily change my overall practice. In general, I do try to repair a Mac off as soon as possible, but I'm not necessarily rushing to the OR that day or necessarily the next day. You know, sometimes it is trying to figure out a good date that works out for both the patient and myself to schedule that surgery. Now, studies like this and some of the other studies certainly does raise the question about whether these patients should be rushed in right away, you know, as soon as possible, versus having that more, a larger window towards repair as traditionally has been there for the Mac-off detachment.
So the interesting thing, and I think the hard thing, is in real life and in the real world, and we're all at academic institutions, but I think sometimes it's just difficult to get operating room access to take a patient for surgery. Now, that doesn't mean that if the outcomes are better, that should be true. Obviously, we should change our strategies and give these patients priority from taking the operating room. But I think we have conflicting data. We have data that says that it matters, and we have data that says it doesn't matter. And I think part of the issue we all understand is every Mac involving detachment is a little bit different. And we've had patients who've been Mac off for quite some time and then go to surgery and they get vision back. And we've had patients who are Mac off for a very short period of time and don't get vision back. So there's some anecdotal data, but the point is it's not so linear that it's well-defined. And as a result, it can be really difficult in certain settings to get ASC or hospital access to take a patient to surgery right away, especially in certain times, such as nights or weekends. I think the other thing, though, I agree with you, Ajay. I try to take every Mac off to surgery as soon as possible. But again, not all Mac-off detachments are created equal. And I think one of the things this study illustrates, again, because it's retrospective, is maybe some of this is still, again, the pre-op vision may be similar between day one, day two, or day three, but maybe there was a reason they were taken day one, right? So maybe the physician saw them and felt that this was just Mac-off, even if the vision was lower, and that should go faster. And then the visual acuity outcomes are better versus they saw them on day one and they're like, well, they've had symptoms for, you know, a little longer, and so they'll take them to surgery in a day or two. Sometimes that subjective part comes into it and creates noise, right? Because I think we've all heard that kind of thing where it's like this person's just phobia off, or the phobia has been off maybe a couple days. And like you said, the history taking is not super accurate from patients. And in general, like you said, the further away you get, there's a correlation where people just don't remember. So again, there's a lot of noise here. I think that this is a very good study to stimulate the conversation. And Dan referenced the studies that are going on, really looking for the ultimate goal, which is to improve outcomes in these cases. But I don't think it changes what I do right now. I agree with you. I think the real question is, does this change anything in terms of if we had something, and I'm going to give an example, if you were able to put what's called like a gas bubble in the eye and flatten out the macula and then take him to surgery, is that something that could be helpful? And that's something people have discussed. I don't do that routinely. But the question is, if you can reattach the macula sooner and then take someone to surgery, especially if you're planning a vitrectomy, is there value to doing that?
And Jay, I think that's a great thought, suggestion, idea. I think something like that would be great if that kind of trial could be done. Because I think what also gets at this idea of, kind of physiologic absorption of fluid, right, versus drainage, you know, assuming that the macula doesn't re-detach when you take the patient with that gas bubble there. But I think I think that's kind of something that's probably been on everyone's mind, and I think unfortunately we haven't had that prospective study to really show us one way or another. But I think that's a really important step to take. And you know, you can imagine that could significantly then shift the way that we practice at that point.
Ajay, your thoughts?
So just for clarifying, so what I understood from this study was that the way that they were determining that time period was the actual duration of detachment, not duration to surgical repair. Is that correct?
That's true, but what I was saying was that the decision, so let's say you have someone who you're sure that the fovea came off today, mm-hmm. the patient's like saying it came off today, and you take him that day, that would count as day one, let's say.
Yeah.
And then there are other times when it's just not so clear, and maybe like, maybe it came off today or yesterday, and then you may take him in a day or two, and then your duration would be like 3 days, for example, instead of a day.
Yeah.
Because again, you're relying on that history, and sometimes, and we have different attendings have different feelings about that, and different patients presented differently in terms of how soon they might have lost vision. You know, sometimes it's like, I lost it this morning. Sometimes it's like, I lost it yesterday. And somehow that does change how different people approach these cases. I think that's the hard part with the retrospective study. I don't know. The history taking is going to muddy this a little bit because you're relying on it to figure out how long the retina. You can't age that, right? You can't just look at the retina and be like, oh, it was off for 3 days versus 2 days versus 1 day.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you know, that's what one of the biggest limitations are, and that's what makes it a little hard to use this study to really change practice patterns. But I think it certainly raises more questions and underscores the importance of looking at this more and maybe even thinking about doing different techniques, like you mentioned with the pneumatic. I know that is something that was mentioned by Efra Mandelkorn as sort of a way to actually get people to feel more comfortable with pneumatics. To use that approach to actually, if a patient that you're planning to bring for a vitrectomy or something like that, or a buccal vitrectomy, you can actually think about trying a pneumatic gas bubble inside the eye, knowing that you plan to take them to surgery, but that could just get you, if you haven't had much experience with pneumatic, just get feeling more comfortable with that process.
Dan, any final thoughts?
I think it just kind of, this all just kind of points out, we still have a lot to learn about, you know, what characteristics affect visual acuity outcomes and retinal detachment. I think some of them have been, you know, is it the duration of fluid? Is it the height of the retinal detachment? Is it like the presence of some kind of biomarker in certain patients that makes it particularly worse? And so I think it's definitely an area that we need to know a lot more about, that hopefully we will in the future years.
Well, Dan Chow, we offered no clues as to your location, except there was holiday music playing in the background.
Oh, you can hear it.
Which means you could be in a little bit. It was good. It got me in the spirit. We're recording this a couple days before Christmas. But Dan, enjoy your flight home from Portland. If anyone
guessed
Portland, there's no prize, but good for you. And Ajay, hope you feel better. Enjoy your Christmas. And guys, thank you for doing this. I'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay.
Thanks, Jay. Good stuff, man.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 146 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. We have rolled out a new feature where two of our bright medical students, Mike Benincasa and Amy Klusterpour, reflect on the latest episode and offer their perspective. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page to find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Episode ideas, feedback, and things that we can improve are always welcome. We also appreciate people who subscribe via the iTunes or Google Play Store to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Daniel Chow and Ajay Kurian. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Benincasa, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Really, the podcast would be impossible without those three and the genius and inspiration they provide. Thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire. It's been a wonderful year, and we have so much to be thankful for. We will be back with another episode after the New Year's holiday next week. This is Jay Schreather, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.